That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said. Well, that's what she said.
Welcome to That's What She Said, conversations with interesting people from the world of sports, music, comedy, and more, talking about their lives, careers, successes, and failures. Hey, everybody, welcome to the latest edition of That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. Excited for you to hear this week's episode because I'm going to call Taryn Killam a friend of the pod. Person who I've been a fan of from afar on Saturday Night Live and plenty of other places, but also online as we became sort of Twitter, Instagram buddies. And I was so excited that when he came on the podcast, he knew what was coming on the Spanish Inquisition and commented on, you know, previous stuff I'd talked about. So always fun to hear when somebody that you are a big admirer of is also kind of a fan of yours. Now, I will warn you, there was a slight delay at times. We got through it, but Taryn is a very busy man promoting what came out as the number one movie in the country in Night School and a brand new sitcom, Single Parents. So busy guy, and he's all over the place right now. In fact, if you check any of his social feeds, you'll see he's doing every late night show, every podcast, every whatever. So I really appreciate him taking out the time to talk to me. And he was in his car. So a very busy man, slight delay at times, but it worked out. Also a happy man because since we chatted at the end of last week, his Los Angeles Rams got yet another W. So I hope you guys enjoy this conversation. We talk about how he got into the Rams, his time at Saturday Night Live, the new projects he's working on. We even do a little joint sing along to the Counting Crows. So enjoy my conversation with Taryn Killam.
That's what she said.
Hey, let's include our hellos in the intro if we want to.
Why not? We're already going. Everyone will get to hear this. It'll be amazing.
People love the BTS.
They love BTS, totally. So that's Taryn Killam.
Not just the Korean pop band.
Yes, that too. Although, now that we've mentioned it, I can put it in the tease and hopefully get all of their fans to listen. And then they'll be gravely disappointed.
Yeah, exactly.
When we don't
discusses BTS.
Talk about K-pop at all. I'm not above that. I'm really not. Taryn Killam, star of the new movie Night School, of course, on the new TV show Single Parents. You know him from SNL and from Mad TV and everything else. And I'm so pumped to talk. And usually I start at the beginning, but I fear if I wait too long to talk to you about your Los Angeles Rams, your head will explode for just desire to unleash the fury of your Rams fandom. So I'm going to start there.
I'd be worried that they'd move up to like 6-0 or 7-0.
Yeah, without us getting to it. Right. At any point, they could be winning a game.
You know what I mean? I'm so nervous that they'd just be dominating, that they'd be scoring 30 points again somewhere in the country.
That is so scary for those of us whose teams don't always score that many points. Let's talk about the Rams because I was reading about your fandom and, you know, some might want to potentially call you a bandwagoner for just saying whatever team gets to LA first, I'm going to root for them and then have it be a team that immediately jumps to the top of the list. But I actually think it's really sweet why you decided to root for them.
Yeah. And, you know, I'll say, like, I welcome and I don't fight against any negative aspersions about my fandom because I fully cop to the fact that, like, I am a new fan. I'm a 3 years new fan, but it never felt authentic to jump onto a team having grown up in Los Angeles and been here. And we had the Rams and Raiders when I was very, very little, but by the time I'd sort of found my passion for football, we were teamless. And I promised myself pretty young in my adult life that whatever team we were getting back, and it looked like it was going to be the Jaguars for a period there. But whatever team I was going all in on, and it was fortuitous that it was the Rams, not because they're dominating the NFL and they're, you know, one of only two undefeated teams, but because the Rams were here before and the first sporting event I was ever taken to is like literally an infant. My parents took me to the Coliseum to see a Rams game.
Nice.
And for me, football is just always something I've loved, and the tradition of it, the gathering element of it, and then having become a fan of the sport, you know, the technique, the strategizing, the athleticism, and it really is, to me, I am excited and proud to be a Rams fan because whether or not I've earned it yet in the eyes of some scrutinizers, I'm dedicated to the pursuit of earning it. if that makes sense.
Yes.
And look forward to their domination and then look forward to their fall too. And I vow to anyone listening that I'll still be there screaming my head off in the stands.
Well, you did tell an interviewer that you were kind of hoping that they would be bad longer so that you could prove to people that it wasn't about bandwagoning.
Yeah. Exactly.
Unfortunately for you, they're the best team in the NFL. That's too bad. There's a great story by Alden Gonzalez about your fandom for the Rams up on ESPN.com, and a friend from college told him that watching games with you is embarrassing. Explain.
I'm not shy about my fandom. I'm not one to just sort of sit and lounge at a game. I'm usually on my feet. I'm yelling my head off every third down when we're on defense. So I think that's what it comes down to.
Elliot
is also one of the three friends that. Yeah, exactly. Posting every time we score. Elliot's also one of three friends that I forced to paint their bodies. The first season they were back with RAMS. So that may have something to do with that comment as well.
Is he also one of the five friends that you made customs Rams jerseys for to trying to turn them into a fan of your team? I just love giving another grown man a custom jersey of a team he doesn't even root for just to try to swing him.
You know, it just, if anything, I'll have them on my side on laundry day.
Right. There you go. It's true. So this stems from, as you mentioned, you were born in Culver City. You grew up in Big Bear, California, and there's a nostalgia to it. I saw that you left home at 16.
Yes.
So is this, was there a falling out with your parents, or is this something that connects you to a time with your parents that was simpler?
I left Big Bear at 16. My parents came with me.
Okay.
I've got a healthy relationship with my folks. Yeah. No, I did not. I finally got out of the house at 18, like most nuclear families.
Right.
It's more about the community. Big Bear is very much a Friday Night Lights kind of town. Big Bear High School is a big deal. And really just sort of the social events, or like fondest memories of gathering for the Super Bowl and, you know, being given $2 to put my initials down in the box score, and just sort of the Sunday ritual, the gathering, that kids playing in the yard, folks hanging out in the kitchen and stuff, but most people gathered around the TV watching and cheering on for their game. I just liked that environment, but I was never fully connected to the cheering for the team part, right? Like that, none of that ever felt sincere or connected to. And why it's so fun to be a Los Angeles Rams fan is kind of this clean slate in many ways. And, you know, the franchise is doing a great job of honoring and recognizing the St. Louis squad and many of the legends that played in L.A. Eric Dickerson's there like every game. But it is new. It's a new, exciting thing, and to get in on the ground floor is an opportunity that, you know, few people have.
Absolutely. And I feel bad for St. Louis fans who don't take their fandom with them. I don't blame them for that. But to see the team do this right after leaving is just heartbreak for those that suffered through the lean times.
Sure.
So your daughter's move when she's in trouble is to try to appeal to your Rams fandom. Tell me about that.
Correct. Yeah, it feels pretty unhealthy. Anytime I'm angry, anytime I'm frustrated, anytime like I like hit my knee on a table and shout a profanity, my oldest child will slink off to her bedroom, put on the Todd Gurley jersey that I bought for her, and come into the room and say, "Who's out?" to shake me out of funk. And
nice.
It is the most endearing, the most heartwarming, and also like really already a daddy issue that I need to sort of need to address.
Well, as long as she keeps liking it, it's fine, right? And if you start buying cars and houses every time she says it, then maybe you'll be a little bit too in deep.
Right, exactly. I just need, feed the addiction. Yeah,
right, exactly. So you left Big Bear. Does that mean you headed to L.A. and that's why you ended up at the L.A. High School for the Arts?
Correct. Yeah. So I auditioned for that the summer of freshman year of high school. My mom sort of arranged it and then found out I got in and decided to go there for sophomore year. And my dad was a contractor. He worked in construction for most of my life. And he would commute. He'd drive down to the South Bay. So for a year, my family still lived in Big Bear. And I would drive down the hill with my dad early, early Monday morning, like 3 a.m. And then I would stay with my grandmother in Long Beach. And she would take me to and from school so that I could go to the LA High School for the Arts. Yeah, it was a real commitment.
What was it about you as a kid that your mom knew to submit you for that, or that there was a future in entertainment?
Yeah, it was definitely like an affinity for performing and singing and dancing. My family is sort of showbiz adjacent. My mother's uncle was Robert Stack, who was like the host of Unsolved Mysteries, and he was the original Elliot Ness. Yeah. I have a cousin, David Bowe, who's been in stuff. He plays Bob in UHF, the Weird Al movie.
Yeah.
So she had an awareness of the industry and took me and my two younger siblings, because we were all pretty cute, co-head, precocious babies. And I was just the one who kind of stuck with it. I could just walk into a room of adults and not shy away and not go into my shell. And then that pretty quickly evolved into participating in community theater and school plays. And so it just sort of stuck. It was something I always liked to do, but my parents definitely like illuminated a path for me to pursue it. But then,
right.
But then if I was always like, if ever I said, I'm over it, I don't want to do it for a while, they were in full support of that. So it was a good balance. It was a pretty, pretty healthy balance.
Yeah, you seem pretty normal for
being
someone
sort
who
of
is
a performing kid.
Yeah, exactly.
I think so.
There's probably a dark underbelly. So. We won't have time to get to it, unfortunately. It'll have to be next time.
We'll find it. My daughter will charge in and bring in her Todd Gurley
jersey
in no time.
Yes, she'll save the day. So 1 year at UCLA, why did you leave? Was it that the screen came calling early?
Yeah, I towards the end of my freshman year, I auditioned for Mad TV and got it at 19 years old. Did half a season there and was asked back, but for like a reduced contract fee, and the representation at the time was like, forget that, and you don't need it. There's other stuff for you out there. So I turned that down, and that really broke my mother's heart, because now I wasn't going to UCLA and I wasn't on Mad TV anymore.
Right.
What the heck are you doing with your life? But I was able to get by with, like, you know, guest stars and pilots and small movie roles. And right after Mad TV, a lot of the folks I'd worked with there, who I really respected and who kind of looked out for me, had come from the Groundlings School, which is a sketch improv theater here in LA.
Yeah.
And it's where like Lorraine Newman came from, and Will Ferrell and Kristen Wiig and Sherry O'Terry and Chris Kattan and Chris Parnell. So I started taking classes there just because I had never really done comedy, specifically like stand-up or sketch or improv, before getting Mad TV. I auditioned with impressions because I was a good mimic. But then I decided I needed some training. So
yeah.
I went to the Groundlings Theater and I was there for like 7 years before SNL saw me.
I was a Second City girl in LA, so we were on opposite sides of the life. Yes, both worthy
Hollywood
of all the
Boulevard
accolades.
Or improv annex.
It was actually on. It was actually by like Fred Siegel for a while there, on Melrose.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Did you take class with Bill?
I did not. I did not have Bill. Is that your guy?
Bill Hader was an L.A.
Oh, Bill Hader. No, I didn't,
Bill Hader
unfortunately.
Did. Second City did L.A. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
Probably bad timing. I wasn't there at the right time. So you did Mad TV.
Yeah.
You had Amanda Bynes' show early on. I read that you had done a bunch of shows, and then you went on The Price is Right. Are you going to shatter my idea that The Price is Right just picks random Midwestern folk that happen to be very good on camera to get on the stage?
I think it's both. I don't think it has to be completely shattered, There might be a little crack in the glass. Because it's a weird thing. I mean, it's so convoluted, the reason I was there. It's just, I had done a pilot for NBC that didn't get picked up, but they put it on YouTube, and it got attention. So NBC gave us an internet web series deal, but the characters we played were fans of TV, so the internet thing was trying to get on TV as much as we could. And like these two like intern slash writers waited in line for us at Price is Right, and then me and Paul showed up and we went on, and I was, yeah, they picked me. They like
That's
selected
so funny.
Me as the sixth person of the whole thing. $6,000 cash and a tennis ball machine.
Wow. And you've put that to good use, I'm sure.
Everything has been downhill ever since. I'm chasing that high. I split it with the guys.
I split
the money with the guys that waited in line for us and the guy I was there with.
That's awesome. A friend of mine that was on a soap opera also did Price is Right, so I think the gig is up. I'm starting to understand how this works. I'm a little worried.
Linda Cardellini's one I know who's done it. So, like, the occasional actor will get in there. But the reason I didn't get to go to the Showcase Showdown was because this, like, little Georgia woman named Selma, who...
I love that you remember that.
...do any sort of TV acting. So I was beaten by an honest-to-goodness, real-life human.
I love that.
Soulless acting machine.
Right, exactly. I also was reading about, you know, getting set up on a blind date and realizing that everyone around you had no idea how old you were. Tell me that story.
Yeah. It was weird. I mean, I'll definitely put it on my friends, because, like, I was 20 at the time, and I think I looked like a pretty... you know, healthy 20-year-old, but I've just always had friends who are older anyway. Like, I've always just, you know, behaved more mature for my age, I guess. But yeah, this woman was 20 years older than me on this blind date. Like, how old do you think I am? And they're like, well, we thought it was certainly within 10 years. I was like, oh man. Oh, I need to hit the gym.
Yeah, I mean, I guess when you get on Mad TV at 19, a year later, people are probably going to assume you're a little more established. So they're gonna add a couple years. So.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I'll say that's what it was, and not my horrible genetics.
Right, that I looked in my 30s when I was 20 years old. You did the Groundlings till 2012, off and on. But in the midst of that, you end up getting SNL, which is the dream of all people in not just improv and sketch, but I would say life. Anybody who has got a real dream, it should be that.
Yeah.
And Eddie Murphy, also my favorite cast member. So you get there, and what are your expectations for yourself? Because I think if you are a fan of the show and you grow up watching it, it must be weird to arrive and try to figure out, who am I going to be? Am I going to be recurring character guy who just hopes to get in the show every week? You know, what were your expectations?
Right. Yeah, I mean, you learn pretty quickly how much control you actually have. You know, yes, your destiny is in your own hands, but also, like, there's a whole system in place. And like anything in life, there's going to be circumstance and there's going to be subjectivity. My time at Mad TV, like, sort of one of the most useful lessons I learned there was patience, because Bobby Lee and I got hired together, and I think, like, when I got there at 19, I was more panicked about, I have to figure out my role, and I have to know who I am, and Bobby was always really good at kind of just sitting back and going, like, they'll use me when they need me, and I'll try to write stuff that's funny to me, but I'm just going to be nice and be easy to work with and help out when I can. And so I went into it with kind of that outlook. Certainly for the first year, and also because of how you said it is the dream job. It's the dream job that my gratitude level, you know, that basically propelled me through the first 2 years of being there without any sort of self scrutinizing or panic of what's my position, what's my role. And then that sets in later.
Yeah, exactly. After you've got your feet wet, then it's like, okay, how do I stay here? Who were some of
the... Yeah, I should be doing more of this. I should be doing less of that. You know?
It's very stressful from everybody I've heard.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. It's crazy. It's amazing that it's even, that it airs, that it exists and it airs, because once you participate, even in just like a single week of production, it's mind-blowing that this thing is happening, and it's happening this quickly, and it's happening live, and that it's been happening for 40 years. It's truly amazing. There's nothing like it.
Yeah, there's no excuses. It goes up whether or not it's ready or all that.
Yes.
You had a great cast, some really fantastic people at the same time as you. Who were some of your favorite people to work with?
I mean, I was spoiled. I'm still very close to Vanessa Bayer and Bobby Moynihan. They're the two people I probably spent the most time with at SNL. But I was lucky when I came in, Kristen was still there, and Andy. Kristen had seen perform at Groundlings before she got SNL. So that was really cool that she was sort of like the first one that made it seem achievable too. Although at the same time, you knew she was like bound for and destined for it because of her talent. But I, to this day, I swear that the biggest perk of being at SNL at the time I was to sit directly across from Fred Armisen and see the sketches he was bringing week after week. And like so nuanced, so niche, specific characters based in human behavior, and just the fun, the hardest I've ever laughed. And one of my all time favorite moments was his last table read. He would always write a joke sketch that like would break the fourth wall very quickly. And then the director would get up and, you know, tell Lauren off. And then some new writer would get up and be like, you people don't deserve me. And it was always really fun, but his last year, he got a little more sentimental, and the Flaming Lips were performing on Fallon that night, and Fred knew them a little bit. So he surprised everybody. He said, he read the sketch and it was really funny. And he was like, okay, now this next thing that's going to happen, it's not going to be sad. It's going to be like a celebration. It's going to be a cool, fun thing. And the Flaming Lips come in and sing, Do You Realize?
Oh, my gosh.
And, like, everybody was sobbing. Everybody was sobbing by the end of it. It was one of the coolest, most magical, special moments of my time there.
Yeah, and when you watch Portlandia, you realize, like, there's a different kind of genius going on there because it is so specific. It's like you found one quality about a person that annoyed you or made you laugh, and then you turned it into a whole sketch. And it's brilliant. It's fascinating to watch.
100%.
One of your favorite my favorite characters of yours was Jebediah Atkinson. In fact, in a previous ESPN radio show that I had, we did a segment called Next. And whenever we didn't want to keep talking about something, we would play the soundbite of Jebediah saying next to move on. Because I just love that idea so much. Do you miss some of the characters because you don't get to get back into that skin?
Yeah, more than like a specific character itself, it's the environment that you're playing that character in.
Right.
You know, if it's Jebediah, it's sitting behind the update desk and, you know, really, really vibing off of the crowd and jokes that they're into. But some of my favorite moments with him were when jokes would just bomb and just like land with a thud because he was so prissy and such a that, you know, that just gave him more fuel to be a and you know, there's techniques you learn at SNL of like performing the cue cards and playing to the multi-camera that like are almost non-existent and useless anywhere but SNL. So I miss that stuff, but more than anything, you just miss the people, you miss the crew, you miss these incredible production heads and crew that are really the heart and soul of the show and the people who are there year after year and make it work, because Lauren and Kenny Among, who is the producer on the show, like they are incredibly loyal to their crew and have to be, because these people are experts and specialists and the best at what they do. And getting to be around those people and getting to see them on a daily basis, that's by far what I miss the most.
A lot of former cast members find their way back by virtue of being the perfect person to play something. I know Nassim Pedrad came back for that great quick turn in that Wild Wild World spoof. I know you were Donald Trump before Baldwin, so that one's taken care of now. But do you have like something in your back pocket where you're like, I hope this person does something awesome or terrible or whatever, because I've got this in my back pocket to go back with?
If Jason DeGrom can win the World Series, then that's sort of the only one that I would dig my heels in on and be like, come on. Who else are you going to find? So I will say that any character that I would be physically perfect for, Colin Jost would be for as well.
But it's a white guy with good hair.
Already have the backup on the cast. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But yeah, but Jason DeGrom, that's
a good one. Yeah, absolutely. Well, you want, now you're in sports mode, so now you're just going to have to convince Lauren to bring you back for some sporty reason.
Exactly. Exactly. When the Rams take the Super Bowl.
There you go.
I'm gonna sneak in, and then I'm just gonna streak across.
Just Winnie the Pooh it with a jersey and no pants.
Exactly. Whose house?
One of my favorite sketches was the Lobster Les Mis, and that was John Mulaney coming back and getting to do something he had pushed for and never got when he was a cast member. Did you have one of those, like the sketch that got away?
Yeah, and every time I go back, the crew are constantly, I talked about it on Seth Meyers' show a week ago or so, but I did this sketch called Chatting Late with Murray Head. And Murray Head sang the song One Night in Bangkok.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like I just have always been kind of fascinated and obsessed with that song because it's a weird cadence and he's like talk singing it. And it's like, one time, very like another when you got another brother. And so the premise of the sketch was that guy, after the success of One Night in Bangkok, was given his own late night talk show, but he could only do the show in the cadence of that song.
It's very specific.
So he's like, hello, my name is Matt Damon, and can you believe it's got a very fun film? It's called The Martian, and can you, this theater's Friday. And people came on, were very confused. it always made me very happy. And the set looked like the music video of One Night in Bangkok, and it was pure insanity, but brought me the most joy in the world.
That's so funny.
Hey, everybody, don't forget to go to ESPN and Apple Podcasts and subscribe to That's What She Said with Sarah Spain so you always have the latest episode. Don't forget to rate and review it as well and tell all your friends how awesome it is.
So you are done and you've put sort of the SNL world behind you, and the new TV show Single Parents, which I've seen the first couple episodes of, is really great. I love the Moana sing-along. I don't even have kids and I know all the words to that song, and I've never seen the movie and I still know all the words. So that was spot on. But what's it like being able to have the same character every week instead of improvising and having multiple characters every show?
Yeah, it's much less stressful. It's really fun. It's the challenge of it is kind of knowing what people are connecting to and knowing what part of that character that people enjoy that you need to honor and maintain, but also not let it become stale and repetitive. So that's been a fascinating new challenge for me. I really, really like getting a new script every week and sort of discovering something new about this guy I'm playing. That's really fun. That's a fun game of like, oh, okay, he used to be a weather producer. All right, awesome. So that's been really fun. And I truly, I'm saying this in interviews a lot, and you feel like it's obligatory when you get a new show, but we all get along really well. The cast and I were all like buddies. We all go hang out even when we don't have to. And that feels particularly special and rare. So I'm pretty happy with the setup, especially because people do seem to be really enjoying it. And that's, you always want people to like what you're doing.
So since you just said you always have to say that about a new show, and then you said it was rare, then that means every other time you've been lying.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Find those clips. Put together a supercut. I dare you. Put
Taryn
together
Kim,
a supercut.
Of
me being a damn liar.
It does look like a fun show to do, though. The working with kids part. Now, you've done a lot of Disney stuff, but it was when you were younger and maybe didn't have kids of your own. So what's it like working with someone else's kids?
Yeah. Again, we've been spoiled just because these kids are freaking pros. They're all like theatrically trained and have done Broadway and live theater. the challenge of it is this scheduling thing, right? Because they are regular cast members on our show, but a group of them can only work 6 hours. Another group of them can only work 8. And the scheduling lives and dies by, you know, how much they do in the episode and having to shoot that out. So it can be a little tricky, like an example being you'll shoot a scene, shoot their coverage in it, and then have to move on to the next scene so that we get their coverage. And then you'll come back and do a scene with like a photo double. And the first time that happened freaked me out. It was actually the episode that airs tonight. I don't know if it's going out tonight, but tonight's episode is about like, it kind of focuses on death and mourning. And there's like a spoiler alert. There's a guinea pig that gets squished.
Oh no.
and we like run into the room to check out why they're screaming. And I run in, and every take I've done with Tyler, the actor, his back was to me, and he turns around and he goes, "He got hurt, you know, the guinea pig got hurt." I run in and nobody told me there's a photo double, and the kid turns around, it's a whole new kid. I'm like, "Who is this? What just happened?"
Oh, that's funny.
I hope that this is just a funny story I get to tell and not a horribly tragic one where an actor got fired.
Right. all I'm thinking right now is Zoolander's child labor laws are silly and outdated. It just seems like it'd be easier if you could just work those kids to the bone.
Exactly.
So you're doing single parents. And by the way, thanks again for doing this, because I am seeing you everywhere. You're not only promoting that, but your movie Night School opened at number one. You're promoting that everywhere as well. You had the premieres 2 days apart. Your biggest concern, of course, was missing the Rams game, not the fact that you were promoting two giant new products or projects.
It's fine. It's fine.
It all worked out.
Sunday is off limits. Yeah.
So tell me about Night School.
I was on Kimmel.
Yes.
I was on Kimmel, and I was like, great. I have to find the closest bar for Monday Night Football. What's the closest sports bar?
Fan.
Night School was awesome. The cast got along so well. We all really liked
each other. It was so rare.
Have you spoken to Kevin before?
I have. He's got a ton of energy.
Yeah.
Such a nice guy, though.
He's pure ambition. You know what I mean? He's just pure hustle and ambition and energy, but finds the time to be decent too. So that was like he really set a good tone on set. And Tiffany Haddish is one of the most impressive people I've ever met in my entire life, and effortlessly funny. And I love her. And then it was just like, you know, me and Rob Riggle and Al Madrigal, who are all three big, you know, football fans, big sports heads, and Marilyn Rice Cub, who suffered through that, but is wonderful. Romany Malco was just the best, and he takes the movie for my money. I think he's the funniest thing in it. So it was great. We hung in Atlanta. Riggle took us to a Falcons game.
Nice.
We got to see the Mercedes-Benz, you know, where they're doing the Super Bowl. That was cool. Got to scope out my seats for when the, you know, 5-0 Rams inevitably ended up there.
Right, of course. Kevin Hart is sort of like a ball of ambition, but Tiffany Haddish is too, and she's sort of like skyrocketed.
Yes.
Is it ever difficult, and I'm sure at SNL the same thing comes up, but even just two funny people or people believe themselves to be funny in one place can sometimes be a lot. What's it like when you've got nonstop coming out of Hart and Haddish and you're trying to be able to be a part of it and not be trampled as well?
I mean, my own personal philosophy on it is that if you're good at comedy, you make enough room for everybody. You want everybody to score, right? It's the people who have the need to dominate and have the need to be the center. I find that exhausting, and I find that if you scratch beneath the surface, there's not much there anyway. And so we sort of had the former on this. We had, you know, Kevin, this is the first movie he's producing. He really, really wanted it to be successful. Tiffany is like in the eye of the storm right now of just, you know, being the hottest thing. But everybody was generous. And that's sort of always what I loved about stand-up about sketch and improv versus stand-up. I've met many stand-up comedians who are generous and funny and like being around funny people. but their career and their whole goal is to be front and center, the one holding that mic. I'm the one that people listen to, and I tell the jokes, where in improv and sketch, it's always ensemble-based, it's always about a group, it's always about a scene or a story, and yes-anding, and building off of each other's ideas. And that's where you know, Riggle comes from, that's where Al, his background is. Al and Mary Lynn both do stand-up now, too, but they have improv backgrounds, so it was great. It was really good. And SNL is the same thing for the most part, you know, except for what's dividing you is that it's just time, just right. Limited time.
Right.
Like, yes, I like that idea. I want to help you make it funny, but I've also got to make sure my thing's good. So bye.
Right.
And that's an interesting type of competition where you almost inherently understand it's not personal because you're mm-hmm. participating in that same competition. You're like, yeah, I know, it's writing night. We basically only have from, you know, 2 until 10 in the morning. We got it. So that also, I think my point with that is that you become very forgiving when
right.
and if, you know, somebody's focused on their own thing. You kind of understand it. And then my sort of, the way I operate is that it'll make me self-check myself. Like, oh, that person's really focusing on their thing. They need this time. And am I doing the same thing? Or is there a way that I can kind of help out and be more selfless?
It also totally gives you an excuse to just interrupt someone and say, stop practicing your bits on me because we don't have time for that. And usually you don't get to do that
oh.
with comedians. You
oh.
just have to sit and you know they're practicing on you and you're like, stop it.
it's the worst. The worst. The when you're in a conversation and suddenly, have you seen this? Works its way into the.
Like, yes. Yeah.
You know,
what
the funniest
the
thing happened to me the other day, and you're
yeah.
like, "What? I was with you the other day. What are you talking about?"
We are running out of time, but I have to quickly ask you, you mentioned, you know, Tiffany Haddish is
yeah.
the big thing right now. You were a part of the big thing in Hamilton, and I just want, you know, a quick take on what it was
yeah.
like. And that's such an amazing character to get to play. I didn't get to see you do it. I saw it in
yes.
Chicago as a different cast, but just tell me what it's like to be a part of something
oh,
that's exactly. that meteoric.
It was really sort of the best rebound job from SNL possible because it does borrow, you know, similar muscles. It's a live show. There's music. It's in New York. It's a very desired ticket. But the time that I came into Hamilton, you know, the show had almost been on for 2 years, and everyone was still so proud, so grateful. And, you know, obviously, you're right. I got this great job, which is like the funniest role in the show. But you only are on stage for about 10 minutes. So it's not, you know, you're not exhausted. Like the dancers, the ensemble of that show are just some of the most incredible, like had the most incredible stamina and agility. And they're just dancing their butts off the whole show. So like I got to just kind of sit back and enjoy it and appreciate it. But what it means to the people who are there to see it, that's what really made it special to me, is that you can feel it every performance. These people have been waiting sometimes
yeah.
up to a year, have spent their, you know, life saving. I mean, like really, like this is a big important moment to them. And more than just the logistics of waiting and money, they love it. They love it and they know it. And they're ready to be taken away. And that, the potency of that emotion and that charge from the 1,300 people who were there for every performance is something I had certainly never experienced before, and something that I really doubt I'll get to be a part of again. So it was the best. It was like fantasy camp. It was like, you know,
yeah.
one, you get to do Broadway. That's a bucket list item. That's so cool. Two, it's that show. It's like the show. It's a masterpiece. It really is a brilliantly crafted, sculpted, written, performed, directed, produced, choreographed show. It's just a piece of art, and I loved every single second that I got to be a part of it.
As someone who has been on a double-decker bus for 3 Blackhawks championship parades and a Cubs championship parade, I'll tell you that if the Rams win it all, and you're on the bus for that. You won't feel as much as part of it because you won't be performing like you were in Hamilton, but that will probably match that feeling in terms of looking out at a sea of thousands and millions of people, even if you know you didn't have a part in actually doing it, but understanding what it means to those people that what's going on in that moment. And that's the closest I felt to being a rock star, even though I didn't contribute at all, didn't swing a bat or anything. But hopefully you'll get that with your Rams too, because that sounds like a similar feeling. It's pretty pretty unbeatable.
Yeah. Awesome.
Before I let you go, you have to do the one thing that everybody does, and it's a speed round, and it's the Spanish Inquisition.
Didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
Number one, what's the natural talent you wish you were gifted with?
Illustration or art, painting, drawing.
That's because you are a singer. Everyone says singer, but you can sing, so you had to get creative. Number two, your desert island album.
I had to think outside the box.
That's right. Your desert island album, you can only have one.
Counting Crows, August, and Everything After.
That's mine! And Aaron Rodgers.
You know, if I had to guess.
I know, right?
Sarah and Aaron are probably.
I was as surprised as you are
that
Aaron Rodgers.
That changed my life.
Me too.
That's awesome.
Love that.
That album, like start to finish, every song.
Yes.
Just out the front door like a ghost
to a fall where no one notices the contrast between white and white. And in between the moon and you, the angels. Yeah. So good. So good. Number three, if you could switch lives with anyone for a day, who would it be?
I am going to say Rihanna.
Ooh, why is that?
Yeah. She just lives life by her own accord. I think I've heard you talk on the show about, you know, switching gender being a big part of it. That's for that.
Yes.
And that, like, spoke to me. I'm like, yeah, for sure. She is, you know, she has this, I think there's obviously a Beyonce comparison of sorts, although I'm sure Beyonce fans would be horrified to hear that. But Beyonce, that kind of pressure, that level of expectation, that's too exhausting. Where Rihanna kind of can, like, she just moves to the tune of, you know, to the beat of her own drummer.
Totally.
I think she's got a pretty good sense of humor. She has, a better sort of global perspective. And I just, you could go on stage. Like, it'd be dope to sing Monster with Eminem on stage as Rihanna.
Yes, absolutely. Number four, what's the most scared you've ever been?
My oldest daughter, when she was like 2.5, fell off the couch and hit her forehead on the corner of the coffee table. And I literally like saw her head and snapped back. And that broke my heart. And then she stood up and her face started pouring blood.
Oh.
And it was the most awful, most horrifying, scared moment of my life. And I hope will be for forever. because that was just, it was the worst. It was literally the worst day of my life.
Number five.
She still has
most...
like a little scar on her forehead.
She does. Oh. Well, it'll probably go away.
Yeah.
We all have some of those from our kids.
It's cute. It's very cute. It's an endearing star.
There you go. Number five, what's the most embarrassed you've ever been?
This is rapid fire, so it's hard. But when I was on Mad TV, the most important album to me then was Tenacious D's first album.
Yeah.
And they came to play at Mad TV. And Michael Hitchcock brought me into their dressing room because he knew Jack Black a little bit. And I got to meet them, and Dave Grohl played drums for them on the album. And when they came to SNL, Dave Grohl played drums for the Tenacious D All-Stars. So now I'm in a dressing room with Jack Black, Kyle Gass, and Dave Grohl. And I sort of like sit down at one moment, but then Mike Hitchcock leaves. And then I'm just stuck in there, in the dressing room. Dave Grohl's talking to a friend about his ranch in West Virginia. And he's like, yeah, we barbecue, we get these great steaks. Oh, man, they're huge. And he sees that I'm, like, eavesdropping. So he very kindly includes me in the conversation. And he's like, you know, big steaks. And I go, oh, well, no, wasn't there. Like a dumb 19-year-old kid trying to be funny to the drummer of Nirvana. And he's like, oh, well, next time, man. And I go, no, well, actually, I'm not allowed in West Virginia. Yeah, not of my silly cows. And he goes, okay, man. And he stops talking to me. And I'm just like, you're an idiot. You're the dumbest. Why do you talk? And I still don't know how to leave the room. I'm so embarrassed to leave the room. And then Michael McDonald, who's a cast member, comes in and tries to get Jack Black to do a sketch. And he's like, hey, Jack, we were just wondering if you're, what's Taryn been here? And everybody turns and looks at me sitting on this couch. And Jack Black goes, yeah, you can kind of tell he's not with the band. And everybody laughs.
Oh,
and
no.
I slowly rise and remove myself from the dressing room.
Magical.
I was mortified.
Magical. You know. Number six, what would you consider your biggest failure?
Ooh. Gosh, my biggest failure. I don't know. Like, you know, failures that matter, like relationship stuff, not staying in touch with people or not, you know, not doing a good enough job of making people who are important in my life feel appreciated, like teachers. I had this wonderful teacher in high school, Norman Cohen, who is my favorite mentor I've ever had. And he passed away, you know, years before I was on SNL. Not really saying enough to him and thanking him enough for the guidance that he's given me, because things I work on today, I often will go back to and think of his lessons. And that feels like a significant one. There's career stuff, and there's like jobs that are, you know, I didn't do a good enough job, you know, didn't do the work that I, you know, that I knew I was capable of. But the relationship stuff, that just seems to be what real life is about. So I wish I said thank you more to him more and to people who matter.
That's a really good one. Number seven, what habit or quality do you think has contributed most to your success?
It's a mixture of hyper self-awareness and lack of self-awareness. The willingness to kind of just put myself out there. But also, usually an ability to read the room and know when to either shut up or back away, except for when I'm at Tenacious D.
Yeah, that is so powerful, that combination. You're so right. Number eight, have you ever been in a fist fight?
I have in middle school, seventh grade, with Matthew Coy, and I was sort of like bullied into it by Brian Mundell, and I didn't want to do it. But all the kids circled up around us and were like, do it. And Matt Coyne had like been a friend of mine, but we'd just grown estranged for whatever kid reasons. And we fought, and like, my memory of it is that I did pretty good, actually. That I landed some hits, and then walking away, I was walking with my buddy Nick Cavanaugh. He's like, good job, man. And I started crying because I hate the way it made me.
That's sad. Number nine, what's the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve?
My body mass index.
It's outdated anyway. Don't worry about it. No one uses that stat anymore. Yeah. No one uses that stat
anymore.
Fair
enough.
You're good. You're good.
Okay. Okay. Cool.
And finally, number 10, what three words would you most hope people would use to describe you?
Oh, you're right. Right. Okay. Funny, decent is one that I've heard people say that I always really like. Present.
Ooh, I like that one. Present is important.
Yeah, thanks.
Speaking of being present, you have a million things going on, and you were here. So thank you so much, and congrats on all your success. It was awesome to talk
to you.
Thank you, Sarah. See you at the Super Bowl parade.
Okay, sounds good. I'm such a fan of yours. So really, really cool to talk to you. Truly.
You too. Thank you
so much.
Truly.
All right, you rock.
See ya.
We'll see you around there.
Oh, And another thing.
This week's That's What She Read is a combo read and watch. And basically, Tim Hortons posted this video to Twitter that got my attention about the Kenyan hockey team that didn't have anyone to play. So they decided that they would send them to the U.S. and give them a couple surprise teammates in the form of Sidney Crosby and another NHL player. And not the United States, Canada. Sorry, Canada. To take on another team and give him a little competition. And the video is just fantastic. So if you search Tim Hortons, The Away Game, you will find this video of Sidney Crosby and this Kenyan team getting a chance to play in Canada. And then it led me to a story from back in February by ESPN's Tom Hamilton called Dreams on Ice. These Kenyans want to play ice hockey in the Winter Olympics. I highly recommend reading that, too. This is just sort of the... It's like the evolution of Cool Runnings, right? We always say that when it's sort of the fish out of water team playing a sport they're not used to. But hearing about these guys and the devotion that they have to this sport that they had always watched from afar and wanted to give a shot to is pretty cool. And watching the video is as well. So check them out. Like I said, Tom Hamilton on ESPN.com from February. These Kenyans want to play ice hockey in the Winter Olympics. And then go to the Tim Hortons Twitter feed or search on YouTube, Tim Hortons, The Away Game, for that awesome video. Thanks, as always, for lasting about an hour with me.
That's what she said.